So, you know, before you have a kid, everyone gives you the tips, the pro tips, the strats, et cetera. And everyone knows, you know, exactly the right thing to do. And I was given a lot of those and I watched a lot of videos and went to classes for safety and everything like that. And not a single one of them, no one, no books, no nothing, mentioned how exactly to build a piss wall. And honestly, I've just had to guess.
Yeah, I'm so glad that we're going to talk about piss wall, which is a cool structure that I think at this point Russ has sent images of to all of us.
And all social media.
Yes.
And all social media. And my wife. It's an amazing thing you've done, Russ.
Thank you.
And I'm no stranger to the dangers of how urine comes flying out of external genitalia.
Yeah.
I get it. I get it. But I've never had to, like, bring engineering into the equation.
Yeah, it definitely is necessary. And just for people at home, if you're looking to build your own piss wall, really all you need to do, go to the store, pick up five of those, pick up two of those, like, five-star folders, you know, the, like, cheap folders that you get.
Right, sure.
Wrap those bad boys in duct tape.
Oh.
Yep, because you could just wipe down duct tape. And
that's true.
And you got yourself a piss wall. Now, it's important to seal the bottom, because if you don't, all the piss just floods right into the bottom of the changing pad, and that's bad. Very bad. Mark II sealed that bad boy, and we got ourselves a piss wall.
Russ, I feel, I don't want to tell you you're a businessman, man, but I never had to build a piss wall. So there's something going, there. I feel like there's something
just
else going on
just
here.
Just because... Egg sandwich. Do we go with ES?
I mean, you could call him by his full, you know, I just like ES for brevity, but okay, if you want to say
Little Eggy.
ES has these like thick blast off ropey threads of urine capable of lifting Russ off of the ground in a comical fashion.
Son of the Mask. Yeah. Sure.
Son of Mask, everybody's favorite movie that they saw that they referenced Baby P. I'm just a guy. You know what? This is a bad, it's all bad to hear about for sure and bad to think about. But it is nice to know that somewhere Russ is getting pissed on. You know, he can't deny it.
If getting peed on is cool, consider me Miles Davis.
He does look like fucking Adam Sandler.
So good.
My name is Justin McElroy, and I know the best game of the week.
My name is Griffin McElroy, and I know the best game of the week.
My name is Christopher Thomas Plant, and I know the best game of the week.
My name is Russ Freshick, and I know the best. Oh my god, I goofed it. I can't even go back now. We're just going to have to live with that.
We're just going to have to sit in it.
Welcome to the Besties, where we sit in it week in and week out. And by it, we mean the latest and greatest in home interactive entertainment. This is a video game club, and just by listening, you yourself are a member. We've got a great new release this week. You know what I'm going to call this one? I'm going to say it's a, bringing it back, Triple I. It's a Triple I game. It's independently developed and published by Revolver, and Devolver, and it's called Death's Door.
What exactly is Death's Door?
Oh, Death's Door?
Please.
Death's Door is kind of like a classic Zelda game with little hints of Dark Souls in there, but friendly.
That's fair?
Yeah, sure.
I think that's a
kind of wrong, but not bad. We're going to take a quick break. No, just like many parts are wrong. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll get back with Death's Door.
I want to mention something before we like get into the game proper. You know, Devolver Digital has done a very good job as a publisher picking a lot of good indie games, but it's important to note that, like, the developer behind this game, Acid Nerve, is, like, kind of the, like, star here. I feel like a lot of people give a lot of attention to Devolver. Well-deserved. But Acid Nerve made this game. You would know their work from... The only other big game that I'm familiar with is called Titan Souls, which was a game that came out that actually has a lot of similarities with this game insofar as, you know, you're a little guy and you're dodging and you're rolling and it's isometric.
That was a cool game.
But that game was more about, like, the it was sort of more Shadow of the Colossus-y.
Yeah, it was entirely bosses, that game. Every single fight was a boss fight.
Usually you only had to hit them once to kill them, so it was, like, a question of, like, figuring out how to do that without getting... It game kicks so much ass.
Yeah, so it's interesting to see them kind of bring a lot of what they learned from that game, which was a very hard game, in my opinion, and kind of make it more approachable and kind of broaden the whole thing with Death's Door, which, as people have mentioned, is fantastic. It really is one of the best games I've played this year.
Plant, I want to apologize. When I said you were wrong, I was thinking about it during the ad break, and I was counting all the fucking enormous pause cash that we were getting for that ad. And I was thinking, like, I can definitely... It had not occurred to me. The Zelda connection, like, I didn't really... I don't know. I didn't really get that vibe, but like I can see how it's kind of a...
There's a fucking hook shot, Justin.
I think what you get what threw me off is when you were saying friendly, I was thinking like narratively speaking, it's a lot darker. That is what kind of like raised my hackles. Basically, this is a game where you are a tiny little baby Grim Reaper, little cute little crow reaper that's supposed to collect souls, and there's a lot of bureaucracy in this world, and basically there's like a big soul that you lost. It's a little abstract. The you know, some of the like narrative stuff, it kind of reminds me of an Ace Team game where it's like it has its own internal logic clearly, but like it's a little bit inscrutable.
I would say, for what it's worth, it does get more direct and explainy as you play. Like there is, as it gets deeper, the narrative gets very clear. But I would agree with Justin. Like you start off, you're in this bureaucracy where a bunch of crows basically act as Grim Reapers and they travel around the world stealing souls. There's this kind of conspiracy going on, and everything's not working as it properly should. So it does get a lot more varied than that.
Yeah, I the comparison to Dark Souls that I made is one, it's a little difficult, you know, fighting enemies, you have to dodge and evade and yada yada yada. It's much friendlier than Dark Souls. You also collect souls whenever you kill something, and then you can go spend them. Unlike Dark Souls, you aren't punished for dying, you just keep the souls that you collected. But the thing that it does story-wise that I like, and I like from any Souls game that kind of tries to do this, is it explores like what it means to have to die so much, because really this is a game about people who don't want to die. You as the crow, when you are out and about retrieving the soul that you've been commissioned to go get, time moves forward for you. But when you are done doing your job, you effectively are eternal. So you're motivated to like do your job efficiently, at least in the canon of the story. And then as time goes on, you meet more and more people who are similarly motivated by evading death and all the problems that comes with that. So I think the story is a little muddy at times, but overall, it's, I hate to say like for a video game story, but for a video game story, it hits more often than not.
I think what really works for me about this game is just the combat. I mean, the similarities to Titan Souls are there. For me, it was a little bit, and it's not quite as, I would say, the game I'm about to reference is, for me, the gold standard of like this isometric sort of action RPG style, but it reminded me a little bit more of Hyper Light Drifter, where you are dropped into basically arenas through this big, you know, series of big sprawling isometric maps that you're exploring. And then you just fight a bunch of guys and you only have, I think, 4 hit points. So if you take 4 hits, like you are dead. It is punishing in that regard. And then also you have an energy meter that you use whenever you start with a bow and arrow, and every time you fire one off, you know, it drains your energy meter, and you regain that by landing melee attacks. So it's fairly straightforward. Like there's not a ton of stuff that you can do in combat. It's really just like doing these melee combos. There's there's different weapons you can unlock that have sort of different feels to them. But really, you're just doing these melee combos, using your ranged weaponry and dodge rolling, and using those things to, you know, avoid getting hit even a few times, which is enough to kill you. It's really smart and it works really well, and it makes you feel like every hit really matters, which is also bolstered by the bizarre way that they handle healing in the game.
Oh, yeah.
Does somebody want to try and explain that?
I really still feel like I don't. You collect seeds, and then when you... It makes a certain sense. Okay, you collect seeds, and you can come across basically planters throughout the world, and you can pop the seed that you get in the planter. And once you do that, the seed is permanently gone from your inventory. But when you pass through it by that planter on another playthrough, it is now a place where you can refill your health permanently.
It's so strange, it's right? Like, it's mixing a few things, right? It's mixing that Estus Flask sort of concept, but it's also, like, it's kind of like expendable save points in games that do that, where it's like, you know, here's a place to rest up between these big combat arenas, but you may or may not be able to afford, like, building that checkpoint up. And I never quite felt like I knew when the right time to use my seeds was, which is a problem for...
You get a lot of seeds that you could just do it literally every time you pass a pot.
Okay, yeah. I definitely had some pods that I passed up because I didn't have enough seeds, but maybe I wasn't as diligent with smashing boxes and shit.
I will, if I could raise my sort of like big complaint with this game. Earlier, you mentioned that there wasn't a penalty for death, and I would strenuously disagree with that, because this game is... I'm not a game designer, so I tend to avoid things like passing judgments like bad or good. I tend to try to think in terms of like what worked for me and didn't work for me. That being said, I think the level design in this game is bad. I think it is end of sentence bad. I think it's bad. I think it's labyrinthine and confusing and not fun. And there's a lot of stuff that is like, a lot of like, go hit this switch, which you can clearly see the gate it's going to open. And now the gate is open. And I'm sorry about wasting 30 seconds of your time. That wasn't mechanically interesting at all. And then when you die, after you've opened up some of these shortcuts, when you die, I've said this specifically to contextualize, for me, it is bad. Because when you die, like, some of the shortcuts have been opened.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's even less guided than it was before, and even more confusing to find your way around. And like, finding like, oh, I remember there was like a little, like in the Metroid or Zelda style where you get an item and later you can go back and unlock a thing. It's really hard, or at least it was for me, really hard to go back and find those things. There's not a map to speak of. It's very confusingly laid out. That was really the biggest challenge for me in this game, was like literally just like finding my way around the world. And it really makes you appreciate games that have honed level design to such a point where it feels like you're being led organically through an environment and without being forced through it.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I kind of had a different vibe from it, and I didn't necessarily, I think art design wise, absolutely totally captured by this game, sound, music, whatever.
The music's so cool.
The music's really good. I kind of agree, but in a different way about the level design. The core structure of the game is basically there is a hub section, and then there's individual dungeons, if you will. And within those dungeons, there are like mini spokes where you, need to find 5 souls of this raven, you know, dead ravens to unlock the next door. But the core structure of each of those dungeons is very consistent, and almost to the point of like, you know, I know how I have to do this in each area, which was a little bit of a downer for me because I wanted to feel a little more lost in this world. And I felt like it was more directed than I would have liked. I did notice the thing you mentioned about shortcuts specifically, I actually really liked, because it felt like Dark Souls insofar as, I was able to flip this switch on my last life, so now I can get back to where I was previously much, much quicker. I don't have to like take this long circuitous route to get back to where I was. This door is now open and I can instantly get there. I could see if you needed to if you were in the middle of a place and you needed to take like a few days off from the game, I could see getting lost in that scenario because it doesn't give you a lot of guidance. But once you're, there are very clear, like, I think stopping points and checkpoints where you just like teleport to that location. And I think in those scenarios, it becomes easier to get around. I just would have, you know, my dream version of this game is something that is more closer to like a Link to the Past, where I feel like I'm in a world that is really just like stretched out in front of me, and it does, I don't necessarily know what it's going to throw at me. Mm-hmm. Whereas here, I felt like it was each of the sections was kind of predictable in that way.
Honest to God, just a map would have.
A map would have really
just like just so, a map would have fixed it.
Wait, you feel the same way too?
I got lost a lot. Like this type of game is my jam. It's just the way that I think the like artistic design of these levels and everything is like is gorgeous and diorama like, and it really worked for me. But also like there were not enough. I don't know, like waypoints, not enough like points of interest, I feel like, for me to navigate these M.C. Escher paintings on my own without some help.
I've completed the game, and I kind of like I feel like I had the same feelings early on and then kind of abandoned them over the course of the game. I get what you mean, Justin, about it feeling like a little confusing and labyrinthian. And I had that, and I also get the need for a map. I really don't know how you would make a map for this game because of the way the camera works. And I don't know if y'all have been getting into like the secrets, but there are dozens of places where you can kind of go through the environment in a strange way, and the camera turns around to reveal the other side of the isometric world. And there are a number of times where like a map... I cannot picture how to create it, to the point where at Polygon we've been like working on guides for this game, and actually having to go about trying to do it ourselves, we're realizing like, oh, so this is why they didn't do it. Like, this is actually quite the challenge. I do think the game is only like 7 to 8 hours. I do think you get your bearings really quickly, especially in the actual world. The one part where I do agree with you is, so the very central hub is the office that you work at, and you go through these doors to get transported back to it. And then as you go across the world, you open more doors in that office. So you go from having like one door that transports you somewhere to having like 20 doors. And remembering, even though it says the area on top of the door, remembering exactly what that area was is a bit of a burden. That said, I about halfway through the game, I kind of had it all in my head. The other thing that I'll say very quickly to Fresh's point about the sameness, I was actually shocked how different at least the visual aesthetic was.
Oh, yeah, sure.
I was prepared for the game to be like very like, okay, now we're in a graveyard, now we're in a castle. And it ends up going to some pretty unexpected, I guess, biomes. By the end of the game, like it adds a lot more color, it adds a lot more just different energies that I think for me prevented that sameness issue.
I do want to mention one other thing that Justin mentioned that I thought was incredibly cool and haven't really seen this in a lot of games before. So Justin mentioned the thing about how you unlock abilities and then you can go back to areas and get secrets using those abilities. And you're right, Justin, like I don't remember those points either. There is actually a guy, an NPC in the game that you can talk to, and he actually feeds you a meal, and while you're eating, he will tell you three areas that you should go check out because there might be something interesting there. And as I understand it, those three areas are limited by your abilities. So he will not recommend stuff unless you have...
Where is this cat?
I would say probably like halfway through the game. He is in like there's like a town area that you...
Yeah. You're also forgetting the most important part about this guy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's an octopus, basically, that is...
The guy is a dead body with an octopus moving around his limbs, and the octopus keeps talking about how he's definitely a real person with human digits who just wants to make you food.
That's very good. Narratively, I kind of... enjoy this game's approach to death. I think it's something that games are like getting a little bit more comfortable talking about. And I like that it is not treated as something of like to be terrified about, but there is like reverence. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know if this continues throughout the game, but like after you beat the first boss, there's like a funeral.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? For the boss, which is weird. Like, you never see that in games. And maybe it's good. Like, Mario would certainly be a lot slower paced if every time you squished a mushroom, Mario's like, now let's take a moment to think about this, bro, that we have done squished. I wanna also mention very quickly how many sort of, like, I think a lot about, this is a very well-considered game. Like, my complaints about the map aside, like, one of the things, a small thing that I love about this game, there's no consumables. And this would have been a game.
Aside from the seeds.
No. They're not consumed. They're utilized. They're not consumed.
Okay.
Right? I mean, right. It's not like you use it and then you get hit and, oh my God, I just wasted it.
That's
right?
True.
So it's much more incentivized to use it. There's a great system that I guess is kind of like reminiscent of Doom, where the way you they keep you from spamming magic, or they rate limit your magic attacks by you refill your magic by doing melee attacks, which is cool because you like it forces you to like kind of use both. And sometimes you would love to do a magic attack, but you need to get in and do some melee to refill that meter. So I thought that was really really a smart way of like, I don't like consumables in games. Yeah. I feel like you never know when the right moment to use it is. And like, this doesn't do that.
Yeah. And talking about getting in there, I struggle with the From Software games and like Sekiro especially. I just don't have the reflexes, but I have the skill. And by that, I mean, like, I can learn it, what the game wants me to do. I just, for whatever reason, it just is too fast and I can't compete. What I really liked about this game and its enemies is it gives you a beat to prepare for the attack. Mm-hmm. Like it forecasts the attack that's coming to you. If you are willing to learn how the enemies work, you should be able to dodge and like hang in the battle. I found it very fair.
Yeah. Fair is a good way of looking at it. I mean, I died mainly when like I let myself get overwhelmed or it's really bad. Like if you die and you just want to blow back to where you were before, it is not as simple as like, oh, I'll just run around these dudes. No problem.
Yeah, no, I think it handles balancing really well. It felt challenging, but not overwhelmingly so to me, which again was an issue that I had with Titan Souls. I think it really honestly for me is one of my favorite games of the year. I'm totally enraptured by it. I think they did an amazing job. And I think really anyone that was into, say, Hades, for example, or as Plant said, I think Legend of Zelda is a good comparison. Definitely checks a lot of those boxes, and kind of from a studio that like has done good work, but nothing quite on this level. So it's really exciting to know to think about what they're going to work on next.
One other thing I want to go back to that Justin mentioned is, you know, the reverence towards death. And I think something I really appreciate about this game is it feels like a mature game. Mm-hmm. Like, not mature, like, you know, M for mature and like so many games that try to be adult or try to like be about very, very, very heavy things. And it's a little over the top. But the way from the music that we talked about, which I think is just like subtle and relaxing and nice, it's beautiful piano music, to the way it talks about death, which is that escaping death is toxic, that the need for eternal life is bad, that fearing death is not helpful to you and is a distraction from life. I think it is engaging in conversations that are heavy and like adult, without making it, without being, I guess, so proud of itself, or without kind of lingering in it. It kind of says what it wants to say, and then it throws you back into chopping up zombie ghouls or whatever you are with as a crow. And I really respect that, and I hope to see more games like this that are comfortable talking about heavy things, but not having that be the only thing about the game.
Yeah. Great game. Highly recommend it.
Yeah, very good. How much does it really cost? Great.
I think it's $20.
That's the real fucking question as far as I'm concerned.
Now, how many hours is it?
How many hours do you get for your dollar bucks?
Per minute, right, yeah.
Is it really 20? Yeah, it's $20.
Which
this
is extremely good value.
This is a steal. Get in here and get this game, guys.
That is ridiculous.
This is going to be a sneaky, creepy, like, this one's going to sneak out. This is going to be one that a lot of people are talking about. I think I saw a story in PC Gamer where it reached 100,000 players in its first week. I think it's going to be a big title. Get in there. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back with more great content.
Hey, everyone. It has been a while. This sounds like I'm reading something, but I'm not. It's been a while since we've talked about folks doing reviews for the besties. I have absolutely loved reading some of the comments and reviews that y'all have written. We really, really appreciate it. If you haven't done one yet, please do. It really helps us out a lot, and it helps spread the show. If you have an iPhone, you just go on an Apple Podcasts app, go to the Besties page, scroll all the way to the bottom, and drop a star or a review thing in there, and we'd really appreciate it. I'd love to see us get, we're closing in on 4,000. It'd be awesome if we could hit 4,000. So please, review the show. Thank you.
Now, Plan, I believe you and I have a date. A play,
play date?
A play date, that is.
Oh, hey, everybody. Are you excited about The Playdate, the new indie video game portable console that plays indie games?
Is it twee?
It's very twee. Do any of you know what this is? Have any of you? Did any
of course,
you
man. Pre-order? It's a weird piece of handheld gaming electronics. Of course I know what it is. I'm
Griffin,
a fucking pervert for this
people?
Stuff.
I could do it. It's powered exclusively by a crank. Anytime you want to play, you crank it up to generate power.
Incorrect.
Like a well. Like the well is fun, and it's a fun well that you have to crank the bucket down into to scoop the fun.
Still not. Still not right. It is a. I would say, odd-looking, like, perfectly square, yellow gaming console. If you're familiar with Teenage Engineering and their products, they are the ones who are building it. And it does have a crank on it, but the crank is a gameplay crank and not a power crank. It's an analog controller that flips out of the thing from the side, and then you use it to play games. There's also buttons and a D-pad, but that crank is a big deal. And then it has like this black and white dot matrix screen that is very, very cool looking. It has the screen sort of reminds me of the Obra Dinn aesthetic, which is appropriate since Lucas Pope is already making a game for this thing.
Which is, by the way, the only reason that I am like, oh man, I think I really, really need to get one if Lucas Pope's making a game for it.
I mean, it's a weird thing, right? It's not going to be for everybody. This is going to be a very specific thing that plays very specific games that are made for it. And I think it's only sort of going to work for you if that is a thing that you care about. But like, that's also a bit of a luxury, right? They're not going to port anything to this machine. The people who make stuff are going to make things specifically for it. What's cool is that the SDK for it is fairly accessible. There is a sort of side application called Pulp that they're releasing, which is like a click and drag game editor that you can use in your browser. So you don't need to know like a bunch of code and stuff. Like ostensibly you can make games in a browser window using Pulp for it. So like that idea is very exciting to me. The idea of like, you know, being able to play people's weird RPG maker like shit on this little specialized handheld is super cool.
Plant, you've played it, no?
Yeah,
Have you played it?
Yeah. So it's okay so far. So the real selling point of the device, and again, like to picture just like two business cards side by side. And roughly like an itty bitty Game Boy. The D-pad, there's only two buttons like a Game Boy, and then the crank. And I've played four games on it. One of them is co-designed by the creator of Katamari Damacy. And there are
Zach Gage has a game that's gonna be on it, right?
Yeah.
They're releasing
yeah.
24 games, one a week after it first launches, that are, I believe, free for whoever.
Yeah, they're releasing games in seasons. Right. But right now, the four games that I tried are like, they're okay. And I don't know why I would expect much more than that, because again, making a full original game is hard, and doing it on a new console with only limited inputs, and one of them being a crank that you have not designed for, is also hard. So it reminds me a little bit of the early days of the original Game Boy, where, you know, like Nintendo itself made a couple of great games, but a lot of the games on the original Game Boy are duds, you know, at worst, or just kind of like weird experiments at best. And that's kind of how I felt playing this. There's a surfing game that you control with a crank that is incredibly difficult to control. And in that way, it reminded me of California Games back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
I think what's weird about it is when the original Game Boy was out, it was such a novelty to play a video game on the go that you would make it work. Like, if the game was too hard or it just wasn't super fun or whatever its problems may be, it didn't matter because you could play a video game on the go.
Right.
And now there are a trillion other things for you to do, including playing video games on your phone. So I think this will appeal to kind of retro gamer fans who are cool with, you know, the limitations of a, you know, itty bitty device like this that feels just like a Game Boy. And I can't imagine this having a huge audience with, you know, people who expect, you know, to play Fortnite on their phone. Nor do I think that it was made for those people, to be clear. Like, that's not the intention.
It really is made for gear weirdos like myself. I feel like I have a collection of Teenage Engineering, like, music synth shit, just because I really like having little gadgets and gizmos. And this is a really slick looking one of those. But also, like, I don't know, the developers who are making games for this thing, like, I feel like that is enough alone for me to. Bennett Foddy has a game that's coming out on it. Like, all of my favorite indie game developers are making games for this little thing, and I don't know, I find that very exciting.
Here is my question, and like, plan, I don't feel like using time, like even spending time with this will like give you the answer you need, but like, it is hard to, especially in the environment that we're in right now, we've heard nothing but the challenges of like spinning up any sort of hardware manufacturing whatsoever. Like, all the consoles have obviously been hugely limited. There's a planetary chip shortage. We just saw like Valve get completely shadracked with demand for the Steam Deck, which is obviously a very different product, but like, scale wise, this certainly seems like it could be overwhelmed the same way. Like, what level of confidence do we have that Panic, who is a company that has obviously dabbled in video games before, with Firewatch and a few others, like, what confidence do we have that they're going to be able to deliver, like, first, that anybody's even going to be able to get these things, that they're going to be like, the quality will be there, that like, the first time out, they're just going to nail this?
I think that they will be okay for three reasons. I think one is, the company itself seems to be very cautious. They like to dot their I's and cross their T's. And I don't think that they would put this into the market if they weren't prepared for it. And I think that's why
this has been in the works. They announced this a couple of years ago, right?
Yeah. And it was supposed to come out in 2020. So I think they've been waiting until they feel comfortable. I think the other thing is, it feels like it's roughly as powerful as like a graphing calculator. Yeah. So I'm not sure that they need the same type of chips that we're seeing, you know, international shortages for. And then three, like we said, I'm just not sure that this is for like a major audience. I think it is like a niche product. And I think it is a passion project for Panic. Like, I think even for them, I imagine that they know that. It feels like a thing that this first season will be the proof of concept. If, you know, people like just getting a new game on their, you know, device every week and talking about it on social media. And if the games themselves are really good. Personally, for me, I really hope that they abandon the crank. I'm sure that there'll be one or two. I hope there are one or two novel games. I hope we get a fishing game. But I would love for people just to be making Game Boy games again, and a new Game Boy game coming out every week that uses the D-pad and the buttons. The crank is fine. It's very charming. It's a toy. But it is not a great way to control video games, at least so far. How whatsoever.
So you, if you buy it, you get this first 12 weeks of two games a week for free?
I believe like that's included? Right.
Man,
believe
even like no extra season. Charge. The economics of that are wild to me. Right?
Well, the device is $180.
Yeah, that seems very reasonable too, right? I mean, that doesn't seem...
I mean, that is extremely expensive. For what you're getting just for the hardware, $180 is like way more expensive than the hardware. But again, you're getting the games and you're getting something that's like pretty, designed within an inch of its life. It's like, obviously they spent a lot of time on the hardware design. So I'm not saying it's not worth that, but factor that in.
Yeah. Some of the games are very bite-sized. Like the surfing game reminds me more of kind of like shareware than it does, you know, a video game, which I don't know if we need to explain what shareware is to our listeners, but like it reminds me of the old kind of free games you would download.
I feel like this could be like, I mean, I also feel like the idea that everybody who has one will get the same games in a week, like maybe some discussion, you know, maybe it would harken back to the days of like iOS where... For a couple of years there, when a new thing would blow up on iOS, everybody would be playing it. Everybody would be talking about it. It was a big deal. It would be cool to see this. I'm not a skeptic about Playdate. I think everything about it is great, and I think that that is going to be what it makes it very challenging. I feel like there is like a variety. Like if you look at the economics right now, saving, especially in like America and in other countries, is like off the charts. Like people have not been spending money for 15 months. Savings, disposable income, they're at an all-time high. And I feel like that's what you've seen with like the Steam Deck, the PS5, Xbox, the demand for those.
Even the OLED Switch, which people are like, ho-hum.
Yeah, ho-hum, gone, sold out, yeah. Gone. I feel like the only thing that makes me nervous about this thing is I think there's going to be massive demand for it.
Well, pre-orders are tomorrow, which is the day before this episode comes out. So we'll know by the time this comes out. Sorry.
We'll see how well this ages.
We got any letters?
Any mail? Yeah. I mean, I asked people for questions about Death's Door, and quite a few people asked why there is no map.
Like a pariah for bringing it up, and like Plant's like clutching his pearls, like what? Poorly designed levels, and you like have been inundated with communicating from people like, help, I'm lost, please send breadcrumbs, I'm lost, help, Plant.
A good idea that I did see here that Patrick mentions on Twitter was, why is there no compass? And I think that could be a way to kind of solve for the problem rather than, you know, like a full map. Fuck.
Okay. You want to talk about fucking annoying. There is a person who's like, this camp, it's to the north. This is an isometric game where you can only go in northeast.
Diagonals?
Yeah, you can only go in diagonals. What the fuck are you talking about?
North is up, Justin. Come on. North is up.
There are two different ups because you can only go northeast or northwest. Infuriating. Infuriating.
Anything else?
another question and comment from Andrew Pothead with surely a love letter to Sigurd. Is that the pronunciation of it? The onion guy from
Yeah.
And he also says, I'm enjoying the puzzle secrets in this. The one you had to solve using reflections to open a door was really cool. That one is great. But the question that he asked for us, what are your favorite weapons so far? And what stats did you invest in?
I focused on speed, like running speed and main attack, which both seemed the most useful to me. And weapon-wise, once I found the daggers, I used those for quite a while. Those are like super fast attacking, shorter range, and that seemed really handy. But I've also found, unlike a lot of games where you like find the weapon and just stick with it, depending on the encounter, I definitely will switch and be like, okay, I'm going to use a long sword or whatever instead. Which is really cool. You could just do that. You could do it in the middle of the... You just pause and switch weapons, which is pretty neat. So,
yeah. One last question, and I promise that we won't give spoilers here, but I do think it's worth addressing for people who are playing the game. Chris asked, what did you all think of the end game after the final boss? So, no spoilers, but I will say, for people who are getting to the end of the game, there is an entire another ending and you have to pursue the tablets of knowledge. And that's like all the kind of hint that you need. And there's a lighthouse in the game. I guess not a lighthouse, a bell tower. But that kind of sends you on the path for the
end. Is this something where you should be doing it as you play normally? Or
no,
is this something
go you back? You can't do it until the end.
I'm going to give that one more little pro tip. There are circles in the game on the ground. They're like stone circles with kind of runes on them. You might think that they're teleport pads and you're going to unlock some sort of ability to use those teleport pads. They are not. They are sewer grates that you need to slam down on. You can do that right at the beginning of the game. I literally played the large percentage of the game not like waiting for the ability to use those.
But you can't jump, right?
No, so you have to be above them and you attack while you're above them.
Okay.
Plant, did you figure that out or am I crazy?
No. No.
You didn't know that until I just
that
said it.
That is hilarious.
Yeah, that's really funny. Because I was just looking at one like, can't wait to start teleporting with this bad boy. But yeah, it's a really good level design.
Anybody been playing anything else?
Real quick, honestly, when it's a game that I really do not care for, I'll just stop after we've talked about it on Besties. I have continued to play Skyward Sword, which says a lot, because there are bad points, as we've discussed. But goddamn, those dungeons keep getting better and better. Last week, Griffin referenced the pirate ship dungeon. That is, I'm gonna go ahead and say, the very best dungeon in any Zelda game ever is that pirate ship dungeon. So if you can stomach the slow parts, of which there are a decent amount, the way I think of it is basically, I think Skyward Sword is 20 hours of some of the best Zelda I've ever played and 10 hours of some of the worst Zelda I've ever played. So if you can stomach through those 10 hours, 20. You will enjoy yourself. And it goes a lot faster now that you can skip dialogue and stuff. So,
would you say that the magic doesn't come in the form of a bold reinvention of the formula that
I'm
served as a
fucking
backbone for this podcast?
I'm going to start a podcast with people that aren't bullies. do we have plans to talk about Neo Tui in a standalone
Not
episode?
Not at present.
Or can I talk a little bit about it? Okay, so there's a new The World Ends With You game.
That's wild.
That came out yesterday, which is fucking wild. It's out on, I believe, Switch and PS4, which is also pretty wild. I'll probably end up circling back on this next week because I've only put like a couple hours into it. But it is very The World Ends With You. It's so weird.
Is it fun? Because I really liked The World Ends With You, but I don't know if I'd have the patience.
Oh, man. It's cool. Like, it's very flashy, and it looks very nice, and it has... It's very stylish, but I don't know... The combat hasn't necessarily swept me off my feet in the same way that The World Ends With You did. Because the big thing for The World Ends With You is when it came out on DS, you were basically... Each fight was taking place in two different sort of screens. You had one where you were doing, you know, kind of mini games, and then you had the other screen where you were using these pins that you collected to execute different attacks, and they are basically kind of replicating that, where you collect these different pins and you can level them up, and each one has a sort of psychokinetic ability tied to it, so you can summon flames or do a sword attack or charge up a kick and let it go, and then you want to string together combos to build a meter that lets you execute like super attacks. But it's been pretty brain dead simple so far, and maybe it will escalate, and maybe like the complexity will become a little bit more rewarding. But I don't necessarily see what the path is to that. I am also playing it on Switch, where there is, I would say, a 4 to 5 second load every time you enter and exit a fight, which is just enough to be fucking annoying. Like, just enough to be... A returning feature of this game is you can chain fights together. So you can turn on this scanner that lets you see noise, which are the enemies that you see floating around on the world map. And you can kind of run through a few of them to chain a few fights together, which increases the difficulty of those fights that you then have to do in sequence, but it also increases like the experience and drops that you get. I have started chaining as many fights together as I possibly can, not because of the rewards that they give, but because it means I don't have to wait through quite as many loading screens to get into the fights. So I don't know if that's as bad on PS4, but obviously, like, Switch is what I play most of my shit on these days. But all that said, like, I don't know, it has a lot of the charm of the original. There's food, you have to figure out the character's favorite foods to increase their stats, and you have to go into Shibuya, like, clothing retailers to find, like, gear in order to not aesthetically change your appearance, unfortunately, but, you know, finding different brands that you can kind of sync up to increase their stat boost. Like, it has all that shit. So, and the story is just as incomprehensible as the first. So if that was a feature you enjoyed, this will probably scratch your itch. So yeah, that's where I'm at. It has not grabbed me, but I think that there was so much that was specific to the platform that World Ends With You, like, had, that I don't know if it'll be able to recreate with a single screen straight up. So, yeah.
Play, you got anything?
Yeah, I have been playing The Ascent, which comes out today when people are listening to this. Do y'all know about this game?
No. Well, yeah. Wait, is it the climbing game on Quest?
No, it's an action RPG that is set in, like, a cyberpunk future, kind of going for a Blade Runner-y vibe. But I would say it reminds me of Diablo and one of my favorite games as a kid, Crusader No Remorse.
Whoa.
Which, for people who played that game, they will definitely remember it. It is incredibly violent and brutal and just weird. And that is this game. It looks like an Unreal Engine tech demo, is the best I can say. And it is similar to what we've been playing with Death's Door, isometric. So beautiful CG world, 3D world, but this old school isometric view. And it's a little simple right now and a little messy at times. Like, I have trouble with the camera going in funky directions, or its waypoints are a little goofy. I keep fighting the same enemy over and over again, all of which sounds bad. And then you get a new weapon that just completely tears through the environment and everything in it, and turns everything into physics objects, and suddenly it's just very fun. I'm not sure where it's going to go from here. The writing so far is not my favorite, which is a problem for a action RPG, but it could get better. I'm still very, very, very early on in it, and I think if people are into those sorts of games, might be worth checking out. I think it's similar to Death's Door. I don't think it's a, quote, full price game. I also think it is on Game Pass, at least on PC. So that might be a good place for you to check it out.
Real quick, I am playing one on, it's an Apple Arcade game. So if you're subscribed to that, you can get it for free. It is a terrible title, which is Tangle Tower, which sounds like, what would you think?
Tangle Tower.
It like just feels like a match three, like,
kind of
garbage.
Yeah, style. Or like a cut the rope type of game.
Exactly. So it's nothing like that. It's a murder mystery adventure. I know, right? It is actually the sequel to a game that came out in 2014 called Detective Grimoire, which was a murder mystery game that came out on iOS, whatever it is now, 7 years ago. This is the sequel to that. You play a guy named Detective Grimoire, and you have an assistant named Sally, and it is a murder mystery adventure, which is sort of like, it has sort of like a Double Fine sort of feel to it a little bit. That's a little bit of that aesthetic. It has a lot of really smart ways of interacting with, like, the mystery part of it. Like, you, when there's something to be solved, you'll have, like, a sort of sentence to form by pulling in pieces of evidence and then figuring out, like, what ties them together. Like, this paintbrush was used to, you know, highlight this thing, and you can pull, like, very organically pull together things that feel smart. Like, it feels like you have to solve it. You can't just, like, sort of stumble your way into it. It's fully voiced and really well acted. The vibe is cool. It's basically like these, there's a murder, and the lead suspect in the murder is a painting, and this is where this begins, right? And you're going from room to room investigating the different people. There's lots of, like, puzzles that you find to find pieces of evidence, which you can then go back and confront people with. But it's like, it's moody, but pretty fun. And
Real quick on that, was that murderer framed?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's the good stuff.
Russ, that's the good shit right there, bud.
I've now lost my appetite to continue talking about this game. Probably for the best. Or indeed continue with the podcast or perhaps my life because of Russ Freshtek. Yet again, that's how I know.
I've got all the things we talked about. We talked about Death's Door, which, hey, for people who don't play a lot of games, but you want to be involved in our year-end conversation about the best games, I'm going to say it right now. You should play this. We will be talking about it again later this year. We also talked about Skyward Sword, which is, it is what it is, but it has a pirate ship dungeon, which is the GOAT. We talked about World Ends With You 2, which is actually called World Ends With You Neo 2.
I think it's actually Neo The World Ends With You.
Okay. And we're going to wait and see on that one. Griffin's going to bring it back next week. We're going to learn a little bit more about it. We talked about The Ascent, which is an action RPG in the cyberpunk aesthetic, and it's on Game Pass. And I will probably bring that back next week, too. And then we talked about Tangled Tower, which is an Apple Arcade murder mystery, which, honestly, those four words have sold me on it. I have become quite an Apple Arcade fan, which I did not think would be the case. Justin, it's time for you to wrap up the show.
Folks, thank you so much for listening. Next week, we're going to talk about the great Ace Attorney Chronicles, so that'll be fun. Until then, we would ask that you recommend the show to somebody you know and love and you think might enjoy it. Review it, just like Freshtek asked for. And just, talk about the besties so we can get more people on board. That is going to do it for us for the besties. So be sure to join us again next week for the besties. Because shouldn't the world's best friends pick the world's best games?
Besties!